Hey folks, welcome to this week's podcast. Interesting guest today, a guy whose career I've followed for a long time, a guy with just giant musical talent. And it's interesting because his career has touched so many incredibly, truly, immensely successful projects, but usually not with the spotlight square on him. I mean, he has a hugely successful solo career, but these plateaus and these heights with so many different artists in so many different roles, it's really unique and interesting. Super, super nice guy, as I expected, and as his reputation preceded him. So, pleasure to talk to. And I just want to, once again, just say one of the upsides of this odd time we're in is that a lot of folks listening to the show, to the podcast, a lot of people commenting and getting in touch with me and sharing their thoughts and feelings about music and just about life, how stuff is going. So I've kind of been enjoying that. So hello to everybody, and thanks to everybody for helping keep me relatively sane. What if I got Sonny Charles from a group called The Checkmates LTD? Amazing Las Vegas lounge act, but also Phil Spector produced a soul music group with a long and unusual career, including a 1974 movie called The Black Connection that I am really looking for a copy to look at. They were the stars of this movie, somehow about a missing heroine and the mob, and it starred the three guys who were in the Checkmates. So anybody has a copy of this movie, The Black Connection, please get in touch with me. I've got to see this before I interview Sonny Charles. Anyway, that's coming up a couple weeks from now. As always, check WFMU.org/Michael for information about upcoming guests and, of course, the archives of all my shows for, I don't know, quite a long while. Back to Paul Carrick. Just great stuff. And nice guy. Enjoy this. This is a solid hour, me and Paul Carrick. Paul Carrick, good morning. This is quite a strange time. Is your mind in a creative space? Are you able to sort of work on music or stuff, or is it just too crazy?
Well, funnily enough, yeah, I'm okay at the minute. I mean, I was touring the UK with my own band, as we normally do, sort of January, February, March. And our last show was the 14th of March at the London Palladium, you know, and it was a great gig, and people were starting to get a bit nervous, but it was a really amazing atmosphere, actually, and the people were really up for it. I was starting to get a bit twitchy about should we really be out here and should people be coming to the shows, you know. And the next day was when they closed all the gigs down, you know. So on the one hand, I was quite relieved, because, as I say, we were out there and exposed, and the crew were out there sitting amongst the audience themselves, you know. But and then I got, for a couple of weeks, I was pretty panicky. I felt rough myself. I think it was a combination of anxiety and fatigue. You know, we'd done 20 odd shows, although we had 6 left to do, but I was very anxious about my family. I have 4 grown-up kids. I don't, not kids, but you know, they're all married and living in inner London. 2 lots of them, and 1 lot's in Brighton. And so I was very nervous. And I people kept saying, "Oh yeah, put something online. You know, do a thing on your iPhone." I just didn't have the I just didn't have the heart to do it. I was in such a panic. But gradually, I got back into the... I have a studio at home, you know, and I must say, last couple of 3 weeks, I've been in here messing about, and I feel a whole lot better. As I say, people, generally speaking, the people are taking this pretty serious and looking out for each other and trying to be safe and I'd feel a lot calmer. I mean, where it's going, heaven only knows, but I'm keeping my mind off it, and I have come up with a few bits and pieces, so I'm okay in a minute.
Oh, that's good to hear. Yeah, it's interesting how March 14th, just we didn't really know a thing, and then all of a sudden it just, boom, it came like a storm, and we all sort of started to figure out how to do it, and I'm glad to hear folks over there are behaving well, because that's probably what it's going to take, at least partly. So you mentioned your kids are in Brighton. Is that where you're from? Because I'm always curious, region, I mean, does where did you grow up, and does that play into who you are, who you became?
Oh, I think so, yeah. I mean, actually, only one. My youngest daughter is down in Brighton. Two of my other kids are in London. And another lot, my eldest, is just around the corner from where I live, just outside. So, but I'm originally from the city of Sheffield, which is up north, you know, in Yorkshire. I grew up about three streets away from Joe Cocker. Joel's a bit older than me, and Yorkshire people and Sheffield people in particular are quite down to earth, to the point of, you might say, dour. You know, they're called dour Yorkshiremen. You know, they don't get carried away about anything. You know, they're very sort of down to earth.
Is that you?
Yeah, I'm pretty down to earth, I think. You know, I had a pretty down to earth childhood and upbringing. You know, my folks were all pretty much working class. Although we had a small store, actually, a small shop that sold wallpaper and paint. And that's where I grew up, at the back of the, we lived in the room at the back of the shop, and the two bedrooms upstairs, and the outside toilet and all that bit. But yeah, I'm fairly down to earth. I mean, I went completely nuts in the 60s, 70s, and did all the stupid things. But I think I must have come fairly full circle now.
So you are, as far as I could tell, the perfect age to have the Beatles totally, you know, blow your mind at age, you know, 10 or 11. Is that what happened?
Definitely. Absolutely. Absolutely saved me, actually, I think, in many ways. Not to dwell on it, but I lost my father. Had a fatal accident when I was around that age. I was 11. And I was already a little bit into music, and he was always encouraged that. So I was already into bands and stuff and music, but when the whole Merseybeat thing hit, yes, I was completely, it completely blew me away. I saw the Beatles at least two occasions at Sheffield City Hall, because City Hall is a theatre, holds about 2,000, and I saw everybody there. Though, I mean, I saw Dylan, Chuck Berry, the Beatles, the Stones, Roy Orbison, Peter, Paul, and Mary, they all came through. And and funnily enough, that's kind of where I play now with my band. So it's unbelievable, really.
Yeah, that's lovely. That is amazing. So I'm happy that your folks, you know, encourage you to go see music. Were you taking lessons? Were you instructed in piano or guitar?
No.
Or what?
No, no. No. No, I never had a lesson in my life. I would have loved them, actually. I wanted to play. I would have liked to have played piano, but there was with no room. I'm serious. We lived in one room at the back of the shop, and but what we did have, we had an attic, and in this attic were a couple of bits of old drums. There was an old snare drum and an old bass drum, a wind-up gramophone, an old accordion, and I started messing around with this stuff, and I was really sort of playing drums. I started out playing drums, and to cut a long story short, you know, as I got into my teens, I was playing drums, but then suddenly I decided I needed to join this band, a soul band, and they needed an organ player. So I actually got my mum to sign the papers for the what we called hire purchase, you know, I don't know what they call it over there in the States now, but and I bought this little crappy organ and started to teach myself a little bit how to play. And my brother played guitar, so there was always a guitar knocking about. So, but no, I've never had a lesson. No,
that's amazing, especially because in your career, you've played with so many different people and, you know, different types of music. And I'm sure that the ability to just jump in and play is important, and to not have lessons. Also, I remember I once saw you when Squeeze toured with Amy Mann. You played drums a part of the thing, so it must have stuck with you. So let's talk about singing, because you're really, really known for, you know, being able to sing the phone book, and it's true, your voice is so amazing. When did you realize that was your gift?
Well, I do remember as a kid, as a very, you know, a young kid, 6'5", 6'7", the teacher remarking about, you know, that, oh, he's got a lovely voice, you know, and I was so, but I wasn't really into that other than singing at school, you know, hymns and such at the assembly and the little songs they used to teach us. When I started to play in bands, you know, which was while I was at school, I didn't sing at all, because usually there'd be a, you know, good looking guy at the front, a designated singer. And I never really sang other than a few background vocals here and there until we formed the band Ace. And that was in the 70s, early 70s. And of course, we managed to get a record deal. And the first song I ever sang, or sang on record for sure, was How Long.
That is blowing my mind. That is amazing. It's so funny, because I had imagined a whole other story where you were just this, you know, little angel singing his way through school. And that was, you know, amazing. So tell me, you sing in a very full voice. You know what I mean? There's no, it's not like you're staring at your shoes trying to sing. Did that take guts, or did that take development? Or was it just, I opened my mouth and that full voice thing came out?
Well, that was kind of the sweet spot, you know. When I first started singing, there was a range where it sounded convincing and exciting, and it was usually fairly high up in the range. In fact, I would say that whenever, you know, you did a new song, basically you pitched it as high as you could to try and get the excitement factor in it. But I mean, I would say now that I'm getting... And my range has expanded a bit, and I'm much more now interested in the lower range and singing in a more intimate style. I mean, I'm a bit more economical with all that full on stuff, you know, because it's high maintenance, you know, especially as I'm getting older and but still touring, you know, quite extensively. It's quite high maintenance to sing in that really full-on voice all the time. So a lot of what I've done more recently as a solo artist has been, I'm conscious of having to sing this maybe three or four nights in a row. You know, so I pitch things a bit lower these days, to be honest.
Yeah, well, that's good maintenance idea. Yeah. So you, as a teen, I guess you're still in school, you start a band called Warm Dust, made a bunch of records. How did Warm Dust get signed to record label? This would be like 1970.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, those records very rarely see the light of day now, because I think they were pretty dreadful. I think we just signed to somebody some bloke who'd started a record label and could afford to put us in a studio for a couple of days, you know. But Warm Dust were, you know, it was kind of progressive rock. And it was, I mean, our hero was Frank Zappa, particularly. You know, we loved the Mothers of Invention, all that stuff. So we used to write these very long pieces, you know, we'd make them up, and then we'd, at some point, go into this completely avant-garde nonsense, you know. And so it was awfully pretentious, but we really believed it, you know. And, you know, this is in my late teens, really. So we, you know, we were living hand to mouth. It was disgusting how I think about how we used to live, you know. We were filthy.
Did you all live in one house together?
Often, yeah. One room, often. I mean, I think the first place we ever rented when we came down to London, literally it was about three floors up at this reggae club, and it was two rooms, and it was crawling with mice, and there was cold water tap, you know. I mean, honestly, I can't believe it. Sometimes I have to think to myself, am I kidding? No, it was rough, but we loved it, you know. It's an adventure.
Yeah. Oh, when you're a teenager, it sounds like, you know, the greatest. So that band dissolves and sort of turns into Ace. And as you say, the first LP has the song How Long, and it goes to number 3 in America, and then number 20 in the UK. And it's one of those songs that's, even though that's massive, it's much more massive than that, because if I've noticed that other songs that made the charts sometimes don't always stick around, whereas somehow How Long is one of those songs that's still on the radio every day, it's still in movies all the time, still in commercials. It's just one of those songs that hasn't aged. You know, it's just something about the way it was produced, the way everything about it. It's just it's still around. So when you were cutting that song, did you have any idea that here we are, you know, 40 years later, we're still talking about that song?
No, not really. I mean, so when we started this, I started to write songs. We'd gone through that trying to be progressive and all the rest of it, and we got into writing, you know, songs, you know. And I was the last one to join, incidentally. There were two members of the Warm Dust, the drummer and the bass player, Tex Colmer. He teamed up with two guitar-playing songwriters. And they decided they needed, you know, keys. And so I was the last one in, to be honest. And so I started to write songs as well. And when I wrote How Long, it was not long before. Well, we were starting to get interest from a few of the small labels in London. And we were doing the song in the set, you know, basically. And a lot of people had sort of said, hey, that could be a single, you know, that could be a hit. And so we thought, oh, okay. So, and when we first got this little recording contract, and I mean, it was a very small label, but we were doing it in the set, and we tried to cut it as a single, and it didn't happen. We weren't very experienced, where we weren't at all experienced in the recording studio, and it didn't happen. So we said, well, you know what, let's just forget it. Let's wait. We'll get down. We booked the studio in the country, in Wales, you know, and we went there for 2 weeks and to record our album, which is kind of what we did. And then the version we came up with for How Long was nothing like I had envisaged originally.
What was the feel originally?
Well, I'm an old sort of soul fan, you know. I loved Motown and all that stuff. And I kind of heard it like a stomping soul song, like as if the Four Tops or somebody were going to do it, you know.
Ah.
And that's how I heard it. But being these sort of old hippies, we kind of came up with that much more sort of mellow West Coast people thought we were American, you know.
How curious. See, that's really interesting. I know that you cut it again in 95 on your Blue Views record, again another top 40 hit for you. Perhaps you should have cut it. You've got a third one in you that's more the Four Tops version.
Well, the first cover I ever had was Bobby Womack.
Yeah. So what is, just a total train spotter question, what's the keyboard on that on the hit version of How Long?
It's a Fender Rhodes.
Yeah, and it sounds so wonderful. So Ace is known for being part of the, quote, pub rock circuit, and I don't think everybody understands exactly what that means. Can you just sort of unpack what that meant?
Well, pub rock, it was kind of, you know, a bit of a sort of... antithesis, is that the word, of the whole progressive thing, which had got really, you know, too big for its boots. And it was kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? Is it an answer to that, you know? People started, instead of trying to form these big groups to play on the festivals with these concept albums and all that, it was just to get back to playing for fun. So it was playing in the pubs of London for beer money, basically, and playing, you know, usually most of them did covers, you know, rock and roll, soul, country, that sort of thing, just bar bands like you have, like you've always had in the States. And was getting back to that, really. So there were a lot of bands around and a lot of places to play, a lot of pubs to play. You know, it didn't cost anything to go in, basically, or maybe you charge a quid on the door or something, and then you'd split the money up at the end of the night. So that's what that was all about. And the record companies started to sign up some of these bands. But as I say, most of them did covers anyway. We must have been the last one to get signed up. And I think it might have been because we did our own, a lot of our own stuff. We did a few covers, but we did original stuff. And maybe How Long, you know, just tipped the balance, because somebody thought, oh, yeah, you know what, that could be a record. So that's what it was all about.
So Ace puts out a bunch of records, and eventually you guys moved to the States, I believe, in the, like, 76 or so. Why move to the States, and, you know, sort of what were your expectations with that, and how did it, how was the timing, and, you know, what were you expecting?
Well, my recollection is that, you know, we had that big hit, and we came over to the States in 75 to do a tour. We were on tour for 3 months. We were the opening act for Yes, who were doing, you know, arenas. And that was a bit of a shock to the system, to be honest. And I think we only just managed to pull it off because we had that big hit. And we spent a lot of time touring behind that hit, you know, both in the US and in England. And meanwhile, people were saying, right, it's about time you did another album. And we didn't really have a lot of songs. And we thought we were the Beatles and we could go in a studio and create an album out of nothing. Of course, I expect that cost us a fortune. But our manager at that time was very keen to be based in America. So we went over to California. We lived just outside Los Angeles, well up the coast a little bit. The band and our wives and girlfriends. It wasn't quite the Manson family, but uh-huh. You know, we had this sort of, we rented some ranch, some rundown ranch, and we lived there, and it was fantastic. It had a swimming pool. We didn't have any money at this point, but we didn't get an awful lot done, to be honest with you. So we made a couple of albums after that first one. We never ever followed up that big hit. And then we went back to the UK slightly with our tails between our legs. And as we arrived in London, it was obvious that things had changed drastically. And it was the whole new wave and punk thing was kicking off. And there we were with our long hair and our beards, and it was thought, well, that's it. It's over. It's us they're singing about.
It's so interesting because you started so young. You know, you've gone already from Zappa to pub rock, you know, and now you're still a young man and things have changed once again. So as far as I could tell, the next sort of step for you, the next big step is playing keyboards with Roxy Music for a while. I believe you're on three of their albums and toured with them a bunch. How did they find you? And again, a sort of a interesting, different musical challenge there. How did you find working with them?
I thought it was great, actually. I mean, as I said, I'd been in the doldrums a little bit. All I knew was that when Ace kind of gave up the ghost around, I think it was about 1978, something like that. So I wanted to, my peers at that time, the guys I kind of looked up to and respected, were these guys who were on the session scenes. And I'm talking about people like Alan Spen and Neil Hubbard from Grease Band. These guys were, that's what they seemed to do. They seemed to play, and I thought, well, I need to get in on that session circuit, but I need to learn how to play a bit better first. And I thought that was how, the way to do it. And as I say, I got in with this bunch who did a lot of the sessions around London at that time, and they had their own little soul band called Kokomo. But one of the things they did, they were doing Brian Ferry's albums, and they said, oh, Brian is putting the Roxy back together, and we're going to play on it. And, you know, they put me forward to play on those records, and that's how that happened. And I thoroughly enjoyed it, actually, although because it was fun, actually. It wasn't it was fun to be out on the road with them. It was a real pop thing, and they, you know, it was great. Enjoyed it.
Yeah, the work on those records is great, and they're real interesting records and quite of their time. And for you, just a way to sort of express a new skill, I assume. So right at the end of that, 81, you get recruited to replace Jules Holland in Squeeze. Were they on your radar? Were you a fan of that band? Did you even know of that band?
Not much, no. I knew their singles, which were played on the radio a lot, and I thought they were kind of just an out-and-out pop band. I wasn't aware that sort of they had a thing going, particularly on the East Coast of America, where they were taken a little bit more seriously. Now, I don't know how much detail you can handle about all this, but so Squeeze were managed by a guy called Miles Copeland, who also managed the Police. And they kind of fallen out with Miles because I don't think they thought they were getting the attention that they deserved. And they were taken on by a guy called Jake Riviera, who was a manager of Elvis Costello and Nick Lowe and various other people. And of course, I knew these guys. I knew Nick and Jake from pub rock days before, but they suddenly found themselves in right in the middle of all this new wave thing that's going on. They'd started this record company, Stiff Records, and all that, and of course Elvis was the jewel in the crown. Nick, of course, was also very popular and successful. So Squeeze had gone with Jake, and Jules Holland had stayed with Miles Copeland. So they needed a keyboard player. They tried everybody, and nobody seemed to fit. And in the end, Jake said, well, what about Paul Carrack? He's kind of back and around. He's doing stuff. He's been playing Roxy. Why don't you give him a whirl? You know, so I turned up, went down to their rehearsal. Right before they're about to start recording an album called East Side Story. And I went down there, and I think they thought, well, he'll have to do.
Wow. That's amazing. You're right in that the East Coast of America, where I'm from, they were, you know, Argy Bargy, each successive record had sort of blown up a little bit more. And by the time East Side Story was out, people were kind of rabid for that band around here. I mean, they headlined Madison Square Garden. You know, they were huge.
They weren't headlining Madison Square Garden at that time.
No, but eventually they did. They were a huge, huge.
They did eventually, after I left.
yeah, I think I first saw them with you at the Palladium with Elvis around then, I believe.
Could well be.
The Trust Tour. So when you get into a situation like that, is it tough learning their entire back catalog? Is that a challenge or is that easy for you?
Yeah, well, no, it was, I'd put a bit of work in learning all that stuff. Yeah, I mean, it was new to me. It was certainly different from the other things I'd been involved with. You know, Ace and all these other little bands I'd been involved with around London were much more sort of rootsy orientated, solely orientated, or playing on, you know, jamming on two chords for 10 minutes, you know, and suddenly, you know, suddenly all these songs with, you know, loads of chord changes and all the rest, it was like, oh my God, I was like hanging on for dear life, really. But it was very exciting.
Yeah, it's quite exciting. Quite a caffeinated band, and yes, Glenn puts just too many chords in sometimes, but he does have this miraculous ear of being able to play the melody off of these very subtle chord changes that I'm, yeah, you know, amazed at. Yeah, so you're in the studio and Elvis Costello produces this record. It's such a fabulous record. It's a lot of people's favorite Squeeze record. He's not a famous record producer, but clearly he had a real impact in you know, it's amazing that they didn't get just John Wood, who had produced Argy Bargy, to produce the next one as well. They went a whole different direction, and the results are wonderful. Was it a pleasant experience making that record?
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah, it was. For me, it was. As I said, it was all new to me. Just, it was a whole different attitude, you know, the sort of new wave aspect of things. And yeah, it was great, and Elvis was great. I think he, you know, he was very diligent. He was very conscientious, and you know, he and of course, he. I got to give him the credit for getting me to sing on Tempted, because I was there to play keyboards, really, and it was his idea that I should sing on Tempted.
Well, there's a bonus version where Glenn sings Tempted, and it's a bit faster, and I don't know if that was recorded first, but when Elvis picked you to sing it, was Glenn put out, or was the whole band, did you just open your mouth and people said, okay, that's clearly...
Well, I think they had already recorded another version with Dave Edmunds. I'm not familiar with it, but I believe it was very different. And, I mean, we'd more or less recorded all the album, and then we just started messing around one day, playing it in that style that became the record, and for, you know, just messing around. And it was Elvis came running in and said, yeah, let's put this down. And then we put, like, the backing track down, and then it was his suggestion. Yeah, why don't you sing it? So yeah, I was only too happy to have a go. But was Glenn put out? I don't know. He didn't show it at the time. You know, I think he was very encouraging. And but I think when it became like a bit of a single and a bit of a hit, I think he wouldn't be human if he didn't feel a little bit put out. Hmm. You know.
Yeah, well, it ended up being their biggest song ever by far. So yes, it's a little bit of fun. But yeah, but you totally earned it. I mean, that's again, you have this habit of being in the right place at the right time, and you know, and that song is again one of those songs that's bigger than it would appear on paper. You know what I mean? It's just a song that's still enjoyed everywhere, and you know, it's just one of those songs that connects to people, and I'm sure it's a song that you cannot do a concert these days without singing that song.
Well, I wouldn't want to, because I love the song. I think it's one of the best pop songs ever written.
Yeah,
to be honest.
So you have you did come back to Squeeze more than once over the years, but you left sort of quickly. Why leave?
Well, I was with them for about a year, and bear in mind, they were an established band when I joined. You know, they had their own way of doing it. They had their singers and their songwriters. They didn't need another one. So, and I was okay. I was quite happy to, you know, be along for the ride, and I was enjoying it. But I knew that in some ways it was, you know, easy to do that, because, you know, they had all the pressure of coming up with the songs and all the singing. And, you know, I always fancied myself as a bit of a singer-songwriter. And I think there was also a situation where the band basically fell out with Jake Riviera. They didn't want to manage him anymore. And I'll be honest with you, I think it was Jake that said, you know what, it's no good. You can't just be along for the ride and be the keyboard player. You're a singer-songwriter, and you should leave and do your own thing. And I listened to him.
Mm. So you end up sort of joining up with Nick Lowe, and who you say you knew from the pub rock days. And it's kind of, so for a while that was the band. It was you and Nick, and sometimes the name of the band changed, and sometimes the headliner name changed, but you guys would sort of take turns backing each other on record and live, and quite a cooking little band. I mean, a really, really great, powerful little band on stage. You made the Carlene Carter album Blue Nun, which is fantastic, and you sing quite a bit on. And then you made Suburban Voodoo, and it's funny because when I announced that I was going to talk to you, a lot of people got in touch to sort of say how much that record Suburban Voodoo, which is your second solo album, what a huge record that was for a lot of people, and it's still a huge record. You know, my daughter, who's 15, walks around the house singing those songs. It's just absolutely, it's a huge record. I mean, I think a lot of people, you know, they sort of see that record like as they see East Side Story. You know, it's just a perfect little pop record. I was going to ask you how you feel about it, but I can tell that to you, it's not quite a milestone.
No. Yes and no. I mean, it's my first real proper solo record. I had made one before that, but we don't need to talk about that. But it was very fueled, I'll give you that. And it was produced by Nick, who was producing Upper Storm at the time. You know, he put a lot into that record. It had a 4-star review in Rolling Stone. And it had a top 30 single, actually, which was I Need You. But it seems it seems a long time ago that now. As I say, it was very, fueled, which was part of the situation at the time. I don't really do much from that. I don't think I do anything from that album.
Yeah, I've noticed that. Yeah. By fuel, do you mean a lot of partying around the making of the record, or emotionally fueled?
You could say that.
Yes,
could say partying.
That band, like I said, toured a lot, opened for Tom Petty, opened for the Cars, you know, a lot of hockey arenas. And
yeah, sorry. I just want to point, because we, you know, you talked about leaving Squeeze and everything, and for some people think that was a bit off, you know, that I think one of the reasons, well, as I said, I felt that I was along for the ride, and it wasn't always comfortable, but you know, nevertheless, and I wanted to work with Nick. He was a bit more of my generation in a way. I was, do you know what I'm saying? Although we're not talking about a lot of years or anything, but you know, anyway, actually you can ignore that, what I just said, but
no, I think it's important. It's funny, because when I last interviewed Nick, I brought up your you know, because when people talk to Nick, they talk about Rockpile so much, but to me, his time with you is equally important, and sometimes maybe doesn't get the microscope quite as deeply, but it's, there's some great stuff in there.
Well, I was a big fan of Rockpile as well. I loved Rockpile, and I thought that's kind of why I was leaving Squeeze, was to work with Nick and have another kind of rock pile. But little did I know that was the last thing on his mind, because he didn't want to be in a band. And really, he didn't want to be in that kind of band. And he wasn't in a great place back then anyway, one way or another. So it was a bit weird, actually, leaving Squeeze. They were very hot. Yeah, the big, you know, that Tempted was a bit of a breakthrough for them. They started to do your Madison Square Gardens and all the rest of it. And I think there was a moment there when I thought, "What was that a good idea?" Anyway, we made that album Suburban Voodoo, and I perked up a little bit. But then, you know, we did, as you were about to say, I think, you know, we did a lot of road work. We did a lot of those arena tours, opening up for people. We opened up for the Cars. We opened up for Tom Petty. You know, and it was lots of miles and miles on the bus, doing half an hour set, 8 o'clock till 8:30 or 8:45, in these arenas where people didn't take much notice, and then a lot of time on the bus drinking and all the rest of it. So after a few years, it got a little bit old.
Yeah, I can imagine. You know, I should remind folks that we're speaking with Paul Carrick this morning, and information about all of the stuff we're talking to is at paulcarrick.net, and I know everybody's got some time on their hands, so spend a little time on Paul's website these days. So one question that I'm dying to know was, did the Nick Lowe, Paul Carrick band ever start to make a follow-up to Suburban Voodoo?
I'm just trying to think. No, I don't think we did. We made a couple of albums for Nick. And as I said, it started to get a little bit old. And I think it ran its course, basically. And I think Nick got a little bit fed up. It was his burden to keep the thing on the road. And we kind of came to the conclusion that maybe, you know, it run its course. And funnily enough, around the time when it was reaching its latter stages, I got the call from Mike Rutherford to ask if I wanted to sing a few songs on what was to become the Mike and the Mechanics record. I think this is what happened.
It's a long time ago. Yeah, well,
it's a long time ago.
Yeah, it's interesting because it sort of dovetails with this next chapter in your career where you're back to that studio guy who's playing on tons of stuff and kind of, you know, keyboard for hire. And then, you know, the Pretenders and the Smiths and I believe even a short tour with Madness. And then, of course, out of all of these things, the Mike and Mechanic becomes, I would imagine, huger than anyone could ever have imagined, right? I mean, you know, Paul Collins was sort of the guy, and I can't imagine folks thought, oh, Mike Rutherford, I'll put my money on him, you know, to have these giant hits. I mean, giant, giant hits. So, yes, you sang that Silent Running song in 85. You put out a solo album, 87, One Good Reason, that had a top 10 hit on it. And then The Living Years from Mike and Mechanics goes to number one. Again, you're just in the right place in the right song. And that's, again, one of those songs that, you know, people sing at weddings. You know, it's a song, again, it's a bigger song than it is on paper. I mean, did they just put those lyrics on a, you know, in front of you on a music stand and say, sing this? Or how did that happen?
Not with The Living Years. I mean, Silent Running, you mentioned, that was the first track I recorded with them. That was the first. And they'd already recorded that backing track, which is three chords, you know, over and over again. But and they literally did give me a piece of paper with some words on it. I thought, how am I going to make these work? You know, take the children and yourself and hide out in the cellar. Oh my goodness! But they said, no, just go in there, just go and blues away. That's what Mike used to say. So there was that. Now, but The Living Years, of course, a different kettle of fish. That's, you know, it. Some people are going to hate it, obviously, but for a lot of people, it's a big song. You know, it means a lot. And I got to say, you know, that lyric, I'm pretty sure, is B.A. Robertson, who co-wrote the song with Mike. You know, that is really his lyric.
Well, especially with your father going so early, that must do, yeah.
Well, I felt I had to sing that song. I mean, because with Mike and the Mechanics, we were basically two lead singers. It was myself and a guy called Paul Young. Not to be confused, there is, you know, a Paul Young, wherever I lay my hat and all that stuff. But it was another guy from Manchester, England, sadly no longer with us. But, and Mike used to have us both sing all the songs just to see who should sing it, you know, which was always a bit uncomfortable. But I thought I had to sing that song because, you know, losing my father had been such a profound thing in my life, you know. Even though it's got nothing to do really with the subject matter of the song, which is about a difficult relationship with a father. But for me, I didn't have that. But I just felt I had to sing because I knew what it was like to lose a father, you know. So I thought, yeah.
Yeah, it's again, just a huge song that, right, love it or hate it, it moves a lot of people, and that counts for something, you know, for sure. So 93, so you start touring with Roger Waters, and that's a regular thing. You go back to Squeeze for a while, and then you join a band, or at least and I'm not sure I've got this right, but you and Timothy B. Schmidt from the Eagles and Don Felder from the Eagles start to mess around a bit. Let's start a band. And in that work to get a band going, you write this song called Love Will Keep Us Alive. And then the Eagles, hell freezes over, literally, and the Eagles get back together, and they need some songs. I guess those guys say, hey, we've got this song in our pocket, and it becomes the most played song in the United States in 1995, which is kind of insane, right? The most played song. Again, it's you kind of being in the right place in the right time for a song that you probably thought would never even see the light of day at a certain point.
Well, you've given the abridged version there, which is fairly accurate, I would say. If you want me to flesh it out in a little more detail, I can. I don't want to bore your listeners to death.
I think they're fascinated. Well, I mean, tell me how you felt about all this. You know, go tell me that side of the story.
Well, that was something that came out completely out of the blue. I mean, I got a call from Don Felder. I'm in England, you know, and I get a call, and this guy says he's Don Felder from the Eagles, you know, and he explained that you know, the Eagles had kind of split up or fallen out or couldn't get back together or whatever, and that they, you know, Timothy and himself, and I believe Joel Walsh at this time, were keen to do something, you know, and he suggested I go over there and write some songs with him and see what would happen. So I went out there, landed in Los Angeles, met with Don Felder, who said, you know, it's crazy, you know, they can't get the Eagles back together, but, you know, let's see if we can do something. I think Joe had sort of bailed at this point and decided to go and get himself sorted out and healthy. So it was Timothy, who I knew, actually, I should have mentioned that I'd met Timothy in 1975 when we had the big hit with Ace, and Timothy was in a band called Poco, and he'd left, you know, he'd of course subsequently joined the Eagles, and he must have remembered me. So I went over, met with Don, Timothy, and another guy, a singer, a great singer called Max Carl, who at that time was working with a band called 38 Special. Does this ring a bell?
Yes, vaguely.
they had a hit at the time, I think. I forget what it's called, but anyway, he's a great guy. So we got together at Felder's place, and I would stay on Don's boat, actually, which was moored in Oxnard, and he had this little boat, and I lived on there for a few weeks, and we started to put songs together, write songs and record them, and it was going to be a band. Yeah. And but one occasion I'd been going backwards and forwards from London to California, and I turned up one day in California, and the guys were like, well, the thing is, Paul, we're going to be getting back together again. So it's like, okay, fair enough.
We're all going to be multimillionaires, but the good news is,
Well, I think Timothy at that point was very happy that they were going to get back together. And he said, you know, if we can just do this run of 10 dates, that will sort me out. And of course, you know, 20, 30 years later, they're still doing it. But anyway, no, but they, one of the songs that we'd been doing was this song, Love Will Keep Us Alive, which was written in the UK by Peter Vale, Jim Capaldi and myself. We took that, and I took the song over and we recorded it. And anyway, Timothy rang up not long after the Eagles had sort of reformed, and he said, you know, I need a song to do on the album. And the guy, you know, well, how about if I did Love Will Keep Us Alive? And we all said, yeah, of course. Fantastic. Great. Do it. And I just should qualify what you, your statement about it being the most played song in the USA that year. It was the most played ASCAP song, or PRS song, which is the English version of PRS. It was that, but it was certainly got a lot of play.
Yes, the ASCAP award. Yeah, it's a. I mean,
something like that.
Yeah, it's kind of insane, really. You played on Something About the Way You Look Tonight and Candle in the Wind, the Elton John double A-side, which also set a record for the new best-selling single of all time in 97. And then 2003, I thought this was interesting because I saw this show. You played with Ringo and his all-star band. That's when Ringo was still sort of changing the band up every year. He seems to have sort of stopped doing that. Tell me about that, because, you know, he's Ringo. And, you know, again, the sort of the thing coming full circle again. Was that I can't tell if that's fun or if that was a drudgery, sort of, only, you know, what's that whole experience like being on those tours?
No, it certainly wasn't drudgery. Oh my god, no. I mean, I just never quite got used to the idea that I was playing in a band with Ringo, you know. I couldn't get over it, so I never really settled down and to be myself. I don't think it's just so much like in awe. In a way, you know, it was unreal. It just wasn't real, because he was the guy, he was the reason. Because as I say, as a kid, I was playing drums. I saw the Beatles at Sheffield City Hall. They were gods. And, you know, it just was too bizarre.
And you know, those solo records are full of great records, great songs, and huge hit singles, and it's just a packed show. Yeah, it's what a wonderful experience just to be in the same room.
The criteria was you had to have 3 hits because you took it in turns. And when I was in the band, it was Colin Hay, John Waite, Sheila E., of course, was playing, Mark Rivera on sax. But Colin, you know, I haven't seen him since, really, but he was great fun. I loved Colin. He was fantastic.
You've ended up playing with Eric Clapton and a bunch of other people, but mostly what you've done since then is sort of established this really significant solo career, lots of terrific albums and these perennial UK mostly tours, Europe, where it seems like you play these rather large theaters and you put on a whole show. You've got a huge band now and you're sort of well seasoned. So tell me a little bit about writing songs, and is it a thing where you wait for lightning to strike, or is it work? You know, how do you do it?
I'd mess around. the lightning very rarely strikes, to be honest. I mean, I'm sitting in my little studio at home now. It's fantastic. I've got a little space here. I've got the digital system, and you know, I play a little bit of everything. I mess around and I just put things together. It's a bit like a jigsaw puzzle. You know, you start with a little nugget of an idea and you gradually flesh it out, and a little bit there and a bit there, and you start to put some words together. So in a sense, I don't see myself as one of those great traditional songwriters. I envy people who just sit down with a guitar and a piece of paper and a pencil and they write a song. I usually just sort of, as I say, piece it together bit by bit. But, you know, that's kind of how it works on the whole for me, you know.
Your voice, to me, is still 100%. You said earlier that you've kind of even expanded your range. Is that luck, or is that a lot of work? You know, have you learned, is there exercises or something you've got to do to keep that happening?
Well, it's just evolved, you know. I mean, funnily enough, I listened to a couple of older recordings the other day, and I thought, wow, I'm right up there, you know, in the range. And as I say, I'm a bit more economical with that these days. I think I'm a better singer now, but it does take a little bit more work. I mean, on the road, I definitely, you know, do warm up exercises and things like that. Not that I know what I'm doing. That's just stuff I've seen on the internet, you know. But it definitely makes a difference. It's actually essential now because you have to sort of get it going before and I have to go through that process because otherwise it's just too frustrating if you can't really do, you know, what you know you can do, you know, on a live situation. I always want to give 100%. I mean, it's a failing, a weakness of me that I really care that I do the best I can do, you know.
I think, you know, especially if you watch, there's a lot of video of you, you know, in the past few years, and you can tell that you're giving it all and that the audiences are eating it up, you know. So tell me if you drive to the supermarket or whatever, what music do you listen to for pleasure?
Very varied taste, really. I don't listen to a lot of contemporary music. I don't know why, whether I'm scared it'll be too good and it'll fry me, you know, away. I mean, I was sitting in the garden yesterday. It was a lovely day. I had a lot of sort of classical, sort of symphonic, English sort of pastoral type music, which I'm fascinated by because there are a couple of composers that who were writing stuff in the sort of 1930s, for instance, even before that, early 20th century. And a lot of these, there's a couple of guys who were very, their thing was to take traditional folk songs and orchestrate them. I'm talking about, I mean, you must have heard of Vaughan Williams, for instance, and other composers. But I also like a bit of jazz. I mean, there's people like Kurt Elling, you know, incredible vocalist, just outrageously talented. But I love old rootsy stuff. I still listen to Hank Williams. I play people like Amos Milburn and, you know, Solomon Burke. I love Solomon Burke. He's my favorite.
Oh, he's fantastic. Yeah, he was on the show a couple of times, and he was such a character, and just could sing amazingly right up until the end there. Yeah, he was just a force force of nature. That guy. So what's next? Your plan is to just assuming all of this blows over eventually, just to keep making records and keep playing, just keep doing your thing.
Well, I guess so. I mean, the thing is, things were going so well. I just knew something was going to turn up, you know. But because I've been so fortunate, I've been very busy the last 5-10 years. It's been the busiest of my career, really, because I've had my own little independent thing going. And I must tell you, this is, you know, an independent thing. It started from scratch. It's why I mostly work in the UK, because I just can't finance the promoting stuff in a big way in other countries. But I've done it the hard way by lots of touring, constantly putting out new stuff, particularly in the UK and certain parts of Europe. So, and then I've had the Clapton stuff on top of that, which has been amazing, you know, to been playing organ in the Clapton band and all his tours for the last, I don't know, 6-7 years. And that's been another fantastic chapter, you know, and it's been constant work. So I'm like, wow, this is just amazing. This year was going to be the busiest ever, but of course the life thing now, which is my main bread and butter, to be honest, is obviously that's gone this year. So I'm in here just messing around in my studio, and I'll probably come up with an album, I guess. But who knows?
How do you? I mean, I look on your career, and it's like if you were to put it on a graph paper, you know, there would be these ups and downs and long plateaus and stuff. And I could see how that could be a bit nerve-wracking. But you, like you said, you're, you know, the Yorkshire down-to-earth guy. Is this something? You know, is this something that you've? Do you feel? Does it make you feel lucky, or, you know, is it?
It makes me feel, yeah, of course, there's an element of that. There's an element of luck. It's been hard work.
Oh, yeah.
And I've always, you know, been prepared to work and to take the rough with the smooth. And I never really fancied the idea of being famous. That wasn't a great motivator for me. I just wanted to survive as a musician, you know, make some music. I mean, survival was a thing. I had four kids and a mortgage. And I didn't see why they should have to suffer for my art, you know. So it was important to me to have a stable family existence, because, you know, I was absolutely knocked sideways as a kid when I lost my father. And I think it made it, you know, I've had an inbuilt insecurity. Fortunately, I was lucky enough to meet a great woman who's, you know, we've been through it all together. And she mostly, to be honest, had brought up four fantastic kids, you know, and that's my main achievement. So, you know, it was pretty, you know, the ups and downs were much more scary when that was all going on, because, you know, when I was the breadwinner, but having got over that hump and still finding myself busy, and actually, you know, paid for the house, had a few quid in the bank till this all started. So I'm the luckiest guy alive.
That's lovely to hear that. You know, it's not, I talk to a lot of people. That's not always how the interview ends, you know, with I'm the luckiest guy alive, you know, so that's lovely to hear. That's wonderful. If you don't mind, I want to play How Long for the folks now, you know, just so you can get another 4 cents on your BMI check or whatever. But when we hear this record, is this, you mentioned, I think it was Rockfield in Wales where it was recorded. Is this, you know, are the vocals a live take? Is the rhythm track a live take? Was it something that took a day to put together, or I assume you played it live so many times you guys had it down?
Well, we had it down. Well, I mean, as I said, we had the studio booked for 2 weeks. Now, we were five-piece band. We were all complete soccer freaks. So when we went down there, we would just play soccer all day and then get loaded at night. And I don't think we had anything worthwhile on tape the first week whatsoever. And then John Anthony, who was producing it, sort of said, you know, we've got to knuckle down now, guys. So, yeah, basically, we set up live in the studio, and the red light would come on. And, you know, you would hope to try and capture a bit of magic, you know, a good take of the song. That's the only way we knew how to do it. We didn't know anything about that, doing it all bit by bit. So pretty sure that, you know, it would have been take number two or three, because after that it would usually get worse. So, and I probably did the vocal. I probably dubbed the vocal live. I would imagine so. I can't actually remember that.
Yeah. Well, I can't blame you. So quite a few years ago. Yeah. 46 yeah. years ago. Yeah, amazing. Well, Paul Carrick, this has been absolutely fascinating. I'm so pleased you could take such a long time for us this morning. Really, really a treat for me and the listeners.
Well, it's a pleasure. And it's a pleasure talking to you. And I hope everybody, you know, stays safe. And I hope one day I can get over there and do a solo tour. My band is absolutely itching to do it. But anyway, as I say, stay safe, and all the best to everybody.